This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There are parents of girls who swear that although they do nothing to encourage it, their bold and inquisitive little daughters hit the princess phase. That's when every game involves dressing up as a princess and the color pink rules. Mary Flanagan wants to encourage these little princesses to become leaders. The artist, writer, inventor, and founder of the Tilt Factor Gaming Lab at Dartmouth has designed a new board game that challenges the heirs of a fictional throne to compete using intelligence and bravery and strength. It is called Monarch and is now raising money on Kickstarter. And Dr. Mary Flanagan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, before the specifics of your new game, more on this kind of pinkification of children's toys, as you call it. Now, what does that mean?
It means taking something that might be interesting to, across genders and really targeting it towards girls. So when I was in high school, my father bought me colored screwdriver sets that were pink because he thought, well, you know, I might like that better. And I really wanted the nice Stanley kind because they had a very long warranty. So being a practical person and having an adventure tinkerer kind of life, I've always really resented as a consumer and as a person this oversimplification of who we are through products. And so I grew up playing Legos, and we all know what happened with the Lego story.
The pink and purple girls' Legos.
Right. So I like to just see what happens when we don't do that, when we really leave open the play space to allow some... to allow youth and to allow adults to really explore identity and all of its intricacies.
So I know that you are a researcher as well. Is there any research linking these kind of gender-designed toys and what girls do become interested in, or boys?
Actually, there are some really interesting data points. In 2004, there was a study about playing with Barbie, and researchers found that playing with Barbie actually reduced the way girls could think of their own careers. This research is actually still coming out now, the kind of ways in which we're really shaped by culture, not just games or computer games, but all the things around us, all the representations around us. In fact, representation of like hyper-sexualized women in video games has been linked to believing rape myths. So, like, misunderstanding what rape is actually linked to the way that we see women in games. So these are some pretty big cultural questions that we have going on here.
Well, tell us about Monarch, because it's interesting. You, on the one hand, are talking about how that princess phase or the pinkification is detrimental to the way that girls think. But at the same time, Monarch is about the heirs to a queen, your princesses.
Right. We try to avoid using that term just because it's easier. It doesn't bring as much loaded baggage. But yes, you are playing as sisters vying for the crown. But really, I was really inspired to create this game from looking at women leaders, actually, through history. You know, in part, this was all inspired by my historical research in chess. And there's a really interesting scholar, Marilyn Yalom, who wrote a book called The Birth of the Chess Queen, and it really tracks how the woman on the board, the queen, appeared. You know, she was not an original member of the cast
of
chess.
No, I didn't know that.
And she appeared, the first chess queen appeared in a set that was found in Lewis Island in the 1100s. So Yalom traces the way the queen became a powerful figure on the board to the way that medieval and Renaissance women became more powerful in society.
Let's also talk about the artwork and the strategy and what goes into putting a board game together. It's a lot of work. You've got a lot of pieces laid out here in front of us.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, there are two kinds of ways that people start to design board games. One is a more of a mechanics-centered approach, like I want this functionality. And then one is more a theme approach, which is the content. So I tend to be a thematic designer. I really want to match what's happening in the game, what players are doing, to a big picture idea. And so that's what I'm really interested in. Monarch became what it is through a long series of play tests with a lot of adults and children. Every week, I was changing something about the game and adding a new feature or changing the balance of numbers of cards and things like that. But Monarch is a game where you, as a player, can use different kinds of strategies to show your worth in ruling the lands. So you rule responsibly, you rule cleverly, and you're able to win.
What was your observation about men playing this game?
Oh, well, that's exactly what we did research on in my research lab, Tilt Factor. We, as the game was being developed, we started asking this question of like, well, do you think we can really get away with using only women as the kind of player characters? And a few hardcore gamers and game publishers actually said, no, we couldn't. We're not in a place where everyone could play as a girl, which is very strange when you think about what's happening in literature, for example. I mean, I don't think only girls, for example, are reading The Hunger Games.
Right.
But there's a little bit of a hesitation on that in board games. So we decided to run some studies. So we did research in a bunch of New Hampshire, Vermont middle schools and high schools with only boys playing the game. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that players, male players who are playing the game, actually, when they get into the characters, actually like the game more than when they're playing as just regular players.
Mm-hmm. This is a board game with different options. You know, there's a level of choose your own adventure based on what is happening, changing the nature of the game based on the choices you make. Now, why did you not design an electronic game for Monarch?
Well, more and more I've been finding, and this is true in my research, at Tilt Factor, we've done several studies about analog versus digital games. We're among the few people who care, actually. So we've done the same game as a digital app, and we've also done it as a board game. And we've found, particularly in a game called Pox Save the People, which is about vaccination, that under the same play conditions, players will actually speak to each other less with a digital game between them than they do with a board game. And they also agree with each other, and they lose the game far more often.
Hmm.
So there's a lot less, I dare say, critical thinking happening when you translate some kinds of gameplay from analog to digital games. And in this case, it was the exact same game played in the exact same conditions. So we do see these differences. I'm really interested in conversations. I'm really interested in people sharing a fantasy world together and creating it, co-creating it. And sometimes a good platform to do that is a board game. And we see this with the increase in board game sales, board game interest, board game cafes. People want to talk to each other and play together.
Mary Flanagan is with us. She's talking about a new game that she's designed called Monarch. She's founding director of Tilt Factor at Dartmouth College. That's a theoretical and practical lab that studies how people play and respond to games and create games for change. Well, so Mary, you mentioned the game Pox. I'd love to know how one designs a game for a public health crisis.
Yeah, well, Pox was designed in 2010, between 2010 and 2011, because a New Hampshire public health group came to the lab and said, you know, we could make another brochure about vaccinations. It doesn't really seem to change hearts and minds. What would? And I thought, well, play. So we created this game that has members of a community out there, and a disease spreads through time, and players work together to stop the virus. So it's a strategy game. It's a little like Go, but a little bit different. It has a 1-4 player kind of setting, and then we decided to move that to an iPad game, and we decided to reskin that game as a zombie game. So we have three versions. We have Zombie Pox, Pox, and Pox Digital. And then, of course, we did studies between them because they're exactly the same game on different platforms. And of all the platforms and all the games, we found that Zombie Pox was actually the most effective at getting people to think about the value of vaccination, even stating they would donate money if they had the means to vaccination, and having people become more empathetic towards those with chronic illness. All that came from a zombie version of the same game. So sometimes outlandish stories, sometimes the most strange stories that distance ourselves from our everyday lives are the most potent as far as belief and behavior.
So, Mary, you're talking about designing social games and games for change, as they are labeled. This is something that you do a lot of at Tilt Factor. What goes on there?
Well, Tilt Factor has been around for over 10 years. It's a game design research lab, and it's a place to ask questions about games, games and learning, games and social impact, and not only ask those questions, but create prototypes, test them, and even produce games. So we go anywhere from asking questions about other people's games to asking questions about our own games, and then designing games that actually meet social needs. So, for example, we invent games that can actually lower social biases and discrimination by playing them. Even party games can actually carry psychological change within them.
I was reading a blog post by someone who had seen you. He watched you speak at a conference and heard your frustration about these quote-unquote educational games and games for change not having enough challenge, not having enough strategy, enough to hold you. What keeps people playing Monarch?
What keeps people playing Monarch? Well, I think because there's a lot of responsiveness in the game system to people's strategy. And you can see, you can chart your own progress really, really well. Monarch is not a, you know, it's not a themed game. It's not saying, oh, play this and you will now be this kind of person. It is really about the fantasy world. It's really about staying in that world, building up your court. The court cards have a little bit of humor. There's a good mix of challenge and strategy built in. And, of course, there's cooperation and healthy competition with your sisters. You know, games are model problem solving. So if we have these intractable global problems and we play games as a way to kind of think through how we think, what if we made games that dealt with more complex systems in a better way? You know, not just like, I won, I killed everyone. But like, okay, I won because I managed these three things and made these four people happy and made this happen. I mean, the cause and effect of the world today really needs to be modeled better in the games we play.
There are Kickstarter campaigns for a lot of board games right now. As you said, you know, it's having a kind of moment in our culture. And I noticed that some of the top earners... Robot Turtles, Bones 2, Zombicide, you know, $2 and $3 million. You're looking for $15,000. Do you think that when you label a game for change or as a learning tool or as a social game, that it diminishes its appeal?
I think it might, which is why this game is not really addressed that way. I mean, and also I think that is because historically games for change haven't always been the most interesting games. I mean, we're inventing a new field. So some of the games that have been invented, you know, they're not so great. A lot of games aren't so great. They don't stick around a long time. I'm trying to make games that do stick around, learning from our mistakes, what we do as a field, and then moving forward into pop culture. So it's really important that the games be cool games first and then, you know, have their social effects as well, because all games do have social effects.
Mary Flanagan, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Mary Flanagan, she's an artist, she's a writer, inventor, and founder of the Tilt Factor Gaming Lab at Dartmouth. You can find a link to the Kickstarter page for Monarch and also more about the Tilt Factor Lab at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, the kind of play that requires a really healthy imagination, LARPing. We're going to speak with the organizer of a large-scale Harry Potter-style role-playing game held in an actual castle. That's when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There are video games, there are board games, and then there is LARPing. For the uninitiated, LARP stands for Live Action Role Play, and more on what that actually entails in a moment. But while the hobby has been gathering steam here in the U.S., it's pretty much gone mainstream in Denmark. Joining me now to explain how popular Nordic LARPing has become and why is Klaus Rosted. He's an avid LARPer, organizer of large-scale LARPs, and acts as a sort of ambassador for the sport. His recent article, LARP Comes Out of the Shadows, appeared in the travel journal Roads and Kingdoms. Klaus, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
For starters, please describe what LARPing is for us, especially if somebody who doesn't know what it means.
Basically, it's let's pretend. And it can be with kids, it can be with adults, it can be orcs and elves in the forest, it can be about being an executive at an advertising agency. It's organized play.
So what does that look like?
It can look like anything. If you do a LARP about an advertising agency, it's going to look like a scene out of the Mad Men series. While if you do a LARP set in the Star Wars universe, then at best it's going to look like a cheap reproduction of a Star Wars movie.
So you're playing characters, basically.
Yes, yes. It's basically improvised theater without a script.
How would you compare it then to acting or historical reenactments?
If I had to compare it to, I'd say that there's a lot of things in common with acting. But with acting, you're acting for someone else's benefit. You're on some kind of stage and you're trying to portray something. While in LARPing, you're trying to get a feel of the emotions yourselves. So we usually, if we want to use fancy terms, we call what we do participatory art, mm-hmm. as opposed to consumer art. I love watching movies. I love reading books. But when I turn a page and the hero does something that I disagree with, I have no options. Here, I can actually be a part of creating the story. And that's magical.
Well, you participated in some pretty out there LARPs, and I don't mean the Game of Thrones fantasy kind. What are some of the roles that you have played?
Well, I've played in something inspired by the occupation of Iraq. I've played a peacekeeping trooper. And that was a little bit different to get a feel for that. Of course, it's nothing like being in Iraq, but you get a little sense of some of the difficulties faced by these people. I've played a snack bar owner on a Muslim spaceship in 2854. That was a little bit strange, but fun.
What is the background for these roles? I mean, do a bunch of people agree to get together and do a LARP?
Yes, basically you have some people who have some kind of creative vision. That could be me, for instance, or other people. And we will find a location for it and we'll find some kind of basic fiction and we'll invite people to come and be a part of it. Hmm. So my next big project is a wizard school at a castle in Poland. So what we've done is basically we've rented a whole castle, which is a hotel by day, and we rented the whole thing and paid some extra to ensure there are no tourists. And then we invite people from all over the world to come and play witches and wizards at this magical college.
Well, you're raising money for this now. It's a big Harry Potter LARP. Let's hear...
It's not Harry Potter.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Inspired by, at least. No. The reason I stress this is due to our deal with Warner Brothers, who has the rights for it. That it's definitely not Harry Potter, but it's inspired by it and by other magical universes.
All right, so let's hear a promotional video for the next wizard event.
Like many of us my age, used to be a Harry Potter fan when I was a kid. And then this game pops up and it's like reliving my teenage years again.
When I saw this, it was like, oh my God, I just have to be there.
Incontinentia! Very nice, we'll do it once more.
In the promotional video, people get to see the look of the castle and the costumes used. Really, absolutely stunning. What else do you have to figure out in order to make a LARP like this pull off?
One thing is you have to have some kind of background fiction. Are we in Rome in the 2nd century? Are we at a wizard school? Are we in space, wherever? And you have to have some kind of structure to make it interesting. In this case, we built the whole structure of the school, how it functions with classes and rivalries between the different sororities, fraternities, and somebody teaches, somebody has lessons. Are there monsters in the forest? What's going on? You have to construct the experience, so to speak.
But I imagine that you have to sort of assign roles to people, right? Because not everybody can be the head wizard.
Yes. Well, whenever people sign up for a LARP, we do some kind of casting. In this case, it's rather easy. Most of the players play students, and some play professors, a groundskeeper, a janitor, and so on.
You're kind of creating your own storyline on some level,
yes.
But I wonder how far that goes for you. I mean, you wouldn't set fire to a forest, obviously. You wouldn't kill somebody, obviously. Playing a peacekeeper or a prisoner, I think, in Guantanamo Bay was one of the LARPs that you've also done. What are the limits of how far you can go in that role?
As with any other kind of play, you agree on what the limits are. If you walk into, a football match, then you agree on what you're allowed to do and what you're not allowed to do. So at the Guantanamo LARP, people were actually tortured using real torture methods. And of course, there are stop words and ways of signaling, okay, this is breaking my boundaries and so on. But as long as you agree, you can play more or less anything.
This is really caught on in the Nordic countries, apparently. What do you think distinguishes the Nordic LARPing scene from others?
There are several things that distinguish the Nordic LARP scene. One is that in the Nordic countries, life is rather safe in general. A lot of people go to some of the kind of, so we say, darker aspects of art to get those experiences because life is rather safe and comfortable in general. That's one thing. Another is that we have a state that funds art activities and culture activities quite a lot. So we're not necessarily dependent on private sponsors to get things running. And thirdly, we don't suffer too much from what I'd call American masculinity culture, mm-hmm. which basically says that anything outside the mainstream is for nerds and they should be beaten up and they have no sex lives or social lives. We can also see this when we get media coverage that while in the Nordic countries, what we do is treated as culture. In some of the American media, it is, but in some of it, it's like, see all these nerds. We should all gather them in one place and laugh at them because they are strange. See, they play and enjoy it. And luckily, we don't suffer as much from that in the Nordic countries. There's still some of it, but it's not as bad. And it means that doing something that's different and strange and requires a big investment is something you're actually allowed to do without becoming a social pariah.
Klaus Rosted, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're more than welcome.
Klaus Rosted, he's an author, an avid LARPer, and you'll find a link to his latest project, which is crowdfunding a wizard-style LARP called The College of Wizardry. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. For Klaus, LARPing is just about the best gig there is. After a break, we're going to speak with somebody else who's living her dream job, a conversation with the queen of rare grooves, DJ Soul Sister, when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Among the gigs that I am grateful to have had is running the studios of WWOZ Community Radio in New Orleans. The DJs at OZ, as it's known, volunteered their time to share their deep love and knowledge of jazz and R&B and local and ethnic music. Some carried their battered albums to the station in shopping bags. Others handled their rare and valuable 45s wearing cotton gloves. All of them passionate about the city's musical heritage and its role in shaping the sound of America. One of the greatest things about that job was the opportunity to put talented people on the air. Among them, Melissa Weber, a bright but fairly shy young woman from one of the city's distinguished musical families who had an infectious hunger for discovering rare grooves. DJ Soul Sister was born. Her Saturday Night Soul Power show is now the longest-running rare groove radio show in the country, and she's thrown down her vinyl-only funk and soul, rare groove, disco, jazz, fusion, true school hip-hop sets from L.A. to London. She's performed at Jazz Fest and the Essence Festival, been featured in documentary films and written for books and magazines, and open shows for acts from the Funky Meters to DJ Questlove. She was personally invited by George Clinton of Parliament Funkadelic to DJ his 71st birthday. And DJ Soul Sister Melissa, I welcome you as today's good gig guest. Hello.
Hello, and thank you so much for that amazing introduction.
Well, it's all true. You're not as shy as you used to be, are you?
Well, the music brings it out of me, you know.
Well, rare groove is a hard thing to define. Tell us what that means to you.
You know, rare groove is sort of a catch-all statement. It refers to soulful music, mainly between the 1970s through mid-1980s. And it can be any genre, as long as it's soulful. It can be soul, funk, disco, underground disco, Brazilian, Latin, as long as it is soulful music. During that time period, that's what most people who are into rare groove define it as.
It's funny talking to someone who grew up in a town so rich with music, you know. I kind of think of that joke of, you know, two fish swimming along and so one says, "How's the water?" and the other says, "What's water?" You've been in it your whole life, you don't know. But I'm wondering if you have any particular memories of listening to or loving music growing up.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, you know, I grew up
being surrounded by vinyl and my dad listening to soulful vinyl. I remember being really little and him playing the Meters Fire on the Bayou LP, and mm-hmm. Teddy Pendergrass' Life is a Song Worth Singing is another favorite of his. And I just have those memories. And the thing with me, because I'm known as a crate digger, I collect vinyl and soulful vinyl, rare groove vinyl. So when I was little, I loved hearing him play these records, but he didn't take really good care of the records. So on one minute, it would be on the turntable. The next, it might be a coaster for a drink of some sort. So eventually, I started like picking up his records and just bringing them to my bedroom and, you know, keeping them safe for him. So his collection became my collection after a while.
Do you remember the first record you bought?
Oh my gosh, yeah. When I was six, my dad took me to a Sound Warehouse record store in about, this was around 1980, and Kool & the Gang had the big, huge song Celebration out. Mm-hmm. And there was a cutout bin, and I was looking through the cutout bin. Of course, the cutout bin is where all of the older, half-price discounted records were kept. And I saw this big album with the words Kool & the Gang on the front. And I'm thinking, oh, this is the big song that everyone likes. I want this song. It was a cutout album from 1972 called Music is the Message. And from there, I was in love with Rare Groove because it was not the big hit record from 1980. Mm. It was this older record, but it has such a soulful sound. And from then on, I just wanted that music. I didn't care if it was a hit or something popular. I just needed that sound in my life.
You were finding your feet as a radio DJ on OZ when CDs still felt a little new. They were kind of all the rage, but you were playing vinyl. Why?
Well, I mean, WWOZ was so cool in that I was listening to this station as a high school student, and I knew that everyone, all of the volunteers on this station, only played the music that they loved the most. So when I started as a volunteer, even though I was like the youngest one there, I think I was 18 or 19, I wanted to do the same exact thing. And all, you know, I'd been collecting vinyl for years, so I just did what made sense to me and what was natural to me.
I was queen of the crate diggers. You've been playing vinyl for a long time. Now so many are catching up with you, you know. And disco is really big now in this era of electronic dance music and dance music. So what do you think? Is everyone finally caught up with DJ Soul Sister Melissa?
Well, I think so. But, you know, with the internet, you learn that there are people all over the world who love the music as much as you, so it closes the gap. When I was at OZ starting in 94, I thought I was the only one. Now you learn that there's a community of millions all over the world. And it was actually a caller to WWOZ from England years ago who gave me the title Queen of Rare Groove. Yeah. And he said that, and I said, okay, wow, people are really hip to this.
Well, if you're going to be dubbed a queen, it should be from an Englishman after all, don't you think? Well, tell me a little bit about the mechanics of the gig. I mean, when you're working with someone like, you know, you're warming up for Chaka Khan or Bootsy Collins or something like that, how do you approach these things? Do you plan them out?
So for when I'm opening for an artist, usually you get a short time slot. It could be anywhere from as short as 10 minutes to an hour and 50 minutes, no longer than that. And usually for that type of thing where I don't have a lot of time to stretch out and improvise, I will plan things out, but I always stray from it. Now, if I'm doing one of my 4 or 5 hour sets, they're not planned at all.
Those are at the clubs, right?
Yes.
That mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Yeah. And it's just as I feel. I feel the feeling, as I like to say. And the set comes as I'm inspired by what's going on.
Well, that must be so interesting. You see in this whole crowd move, they're responding to everything that you're doing. Do you have any, like, surefire, hit 'em out of the park records that you pull out, you know, when things are just hitting the apex?
You know, I honestly have no idea what I'm going to play before I play it. You know, it hits me at that second. Now, when I'm opening for an artist, I have a secret that I'm happy to share with you. I play for the artist that I'm opening for. Mm-hmm. That is my secret. Because if I can fire them up, then the crowd will be fired up, and then the band will come out and throw down. And that's what we want.
You know, it strikes me when you're talking about soul, you know, this is music that was made 30, 40, 50 years ago in some cases. What is it that transcends the years, the decades, and makes this music still work?
Because it feels good. It's a warm feeling, and at my parties, there are people of all kinds, young to old, all types, and everybody wants that good feeling. So that's the only explanation that I can give. Now, in terms of Rare Groove, because I'm always looking for music that may have never made it on any type of Billboard chart, or when it was released, maybe only 100 or 200 copies were pressed. In terms of Rare Groove, it's new to me.
So we're speaking to you with Mardi Gras just behind you. Lent has begun in New Orleans. What's a Rare Groove? What's a song for Lent? From the DJ Soul Sister.
Oh, how about this? How about this one? Happiness Is Now by Freddie Hubbard from 1980.
Sounds great to me. We'll play it on the way out. DJ Soul Sister Melissa Weber, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Melissa Weber, she's better known as DJ Soul Sister, and you can find and listen to much more of what she does, including her Soul Power shows from WWOZ Radio online. She also has a number of regular gigs that she does in New Orleans. If you go on down there, you got to check her out. There's more online about her and her gigs at wordofmouthradio.org. Another exploratory and unusual job. Our series Uncommon Core continues with the Chancellor of Oaksterdam University, America's first cannabis college. That's after a short break when Word of Mouth returns. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Each Thursday, we bring you the Uncommon Core, a series that explores unusual courses offered at colleges and universities across the country. Today, we hear from the head of a school that is pioneering a never-before-taught curriculum, not in the U.S. anyway, on the business of cannabis.
Hi, my name is Dale Sky Jones, and I'm the Executive Chancellor for Oaksterdam University. There's two different tracks for our educational program. One is for the folks that just want horticulture, and more horticulture. They just want to learn how to grow.
You want to keep your humidity at about 40% if you're growing indicas, and about 60% if you're growing sativas.
With respect to the business classes, we're not trying to recreate the wheel. You still need to go get an MBA if that's the type of education that you're trying to achieve. What we're here to do is teach you how to apply a business skill set to the cannabis industry.
Marijuana, the burning weed with its roots in hell.
You have social risk, political risk, but the hardest part is the legal risk. You're up against the wall with not being able to actually deduct normal business cost and practices, overhead, things like rent and employees that any normal business should be able to deduct. And so it's up to you to understand how to navigate both the federal ridiculousness that's currently going on with this federal versus state law issue, but also how to navigate your local community.
In this film, you will see the ease with which this vicious plant can be grown in your neighbor's yard, hidden in an innocent shoe or watch case.
We at our school actually have a rule that the employees themselves voted on. They say that they don't want to allow people to work while they're on edibles or right after they've dabbed, because it tends to kind of zonk you a little bit. Let's roll another joint. However, many of our employees also happen to be patients. And so we don't have a zero tolerance policy on cannabis, but we do have a responsible use policy at the school.
I would recommend this to anybody, regardless of what level you're at. It's a great place to come meet people and network, learn a lot about the culture and the laws and like the media and the history of marijuana.
I learned a lot more than I expected to.
The first two classes are politics and history, so that you understand how you got here, how we got here. And then your second class, legal, federal versus state law, followed up quickly by civics. You very quickly understand that this is not for the faint-hearted. In fact, this is for the very brave.
The doors to Oaksterdam University in the Bay Area were cordoned off by yellow tape and blocked by U.S. Marshals. It was an unexpected move.
And we have had students over the years walk out after the first 2 hours because they've realized it's not for them. But I've also found that the folks that come in just wanting to make money very quickly grow a heart, because they realize who it is they're helping, and it's kind of hard to ignore that when it's staring you in the face.
Well, in Whoville, they say that the Grinch's small heart grew 3 sizes that day.
We've had several conversations with different colleges over the years and quietly worked together on several different projects. Eventually, they will take on this curriculum. And I see Oaksterdam being positioned to supply the curriculum to these colleges rather than have them write it from scratch. And so I completely expect, as we move forward, to form alliances, work on curriculum together, and likely compete with one another in the future.
I'm in love with Mary Jane. She's my main thing. She makes me feel...
One of my biggest opponents in the field of cannabis policy reform has told me that we're not a real school until we have a fight song and a football team. So anyone out there wants to work on that for me, I'm all ears.
The Uncommon Core is produced by Taylor Quimby, and you can check out our previous episodes from the series online. Just go to the series tab at nhpr.org and click on the Uncommon Core. Well, maybe becoming a cannabis entrepreneur is not the path to a paycheck that you would choose. You could try something that won't get you arrested, perhaps writing fiction for the Amazon Kindle's profitable erotic romance genre. After all, the 50 Shades of Grey series sold millions, but was never thought of as good writing. So how hard could it be? That is what the writer Matthew Morgan thought when a friend told him that there is easy money to be made writing salacious stories for the Kindle. So Matthew gave it a shot and then wrote about his experience for the millions. Matthew Morgan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So how much money can people make writing erotica for Kindle?
Theoretically, an endless amount, I guess. E.L. James, I don't know if she published specifically on that site. I don't think so, but like I mentioned in the article, I have a friend who makes, you know, a couple hundred a month doing it. I don't know how she does it, but I guess just a lot of ambition. And she has the drive. I don't have the drive.
So, but you did try it. Are you qualified to write this kind of thing? I mean, have you ever written any erotica before?
I've never written any erotica before, but I thought, you know, I've written a lot of fiction in general, and I got, you know, I've read a lot of Shakespeare and Dostoevsky and stuff like that. So, you know, I figured I had the tools
to write smut.
Yeah, pretty much. I thought I'd give it a go.
So how did you go about researching what kind of things people want to read?
Well, I spent some time on the Amazon Kindle romance section, looking through the short stories they have there. And, you know, they have pretty much everything you could imagine in terms of combinations of magical creatures that transform and have sex with humans.
What? Wait a minute. Yep. What? I'm sorry. This is a genre I don't know about. Magical creatures transforming and having sex with humans. Tell
me. Well, I guess there's just a big market for it. I have no idea why, but pretty much every creature you can imagine, you know, whales, dolphins, bears, they shapeshift into humans and then, you know, they'll have sex with other humans. And there's a big market for it.
Wow. Okay. So is anything off limits for Kindle readers as far as you know?
Yeah. There's a line in the sand. You can't, no overt bestiality. So the creatures have to shapeshift and then no rape.
No rape.
Yep. Has to be consensual.
Okay, so you found this formula. What did you end up writing about?
The whole process was really uncomfortable and not as fun as I thought it would be, just because it's so out of my wheelhouse. And because there's so much of it on Amazon Kindle, I just sort of took a bunch of different paranormal ideas and then smashed them together to try and make something new that people might want to read. So in my story, I had dragons and ghosts and, you know, an underground sex club and all that kind of stuff. So just try and get people interested in a little bit of novelty.
Well, how did it go over, Matthew? I mean, the point of this was about making money. Did Kindle readers enjoy your experiment in erotica?
I don't think so. I think I had a total of 3 or 4 readers at the end, and they were all people who had a Kindle Unlimited account, so they got to read it for free. So I didn't get any royalties, and I just didn't think I didn't think it through when I started. I just had weird fantasies that I would make crazy amounts of money.
So any recommendations for another would-be writer who is running out of cash? Maybe a formula for them to be successful as a romance erotica writer on Kindle?
Yeah, I mean, if you have the drive, I think there's money to be made there. I'd go for it. I mean, if I'm a really lazy person, so, you know, one was enough for me. If I'm not passionate about it, I can't really keep doing it. But if someone is interested in this kind of stuff, I think you can make some money on there. Like I said, my friend makes some money, so just sort of how hard you're willing to work.
Well, Matthew Morgan, a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Matthew Morgan is a writer, and he wrote Pansexual Free-for-All. That's about his brief dalliance as a writer of Kindle erotica. There's a link to read the article for yourself. It's very funny. At wordofmouthradio.org. Well, today we've been talking all about good gigs and odd jobs. So why not wrap up the show with one of the region's actual upcoming gigs? Punch Brothers will be playing this Saturday at the State Theater in Portland, Maine. Featuring Chris Thiele, formerly of Nickel Creek, Punch Brothers formed in the mid-2000s and combined elements of classical composition with bluegrass and pop. Here's a song off their most recent album, The Phosphorescent Blues. It's called My Oh My. Yesterday, we caught up with Punch Brothers violinist and drummer Gabe Witcher. He described how this track came to be.
We play a song, or have played a song, called Dead Leaves in the Dirty Ground by the White Stripes. And so there's a little mandolin run that Chris Thiele came up with, you know, to play in that cover to kind of make it sound more mandolin-like. He played that riff, and then as he told me, he said, I just wanted to know what it would sound like if I turned that riff back into an indie rock kind of thing. And so, you know, he played the original, and then, and just kind of chuckled to himself and went, well, that's dumb, and moved on. And then about 5 minutes later, he went, wait a minute, that thing's still stuck in my head. Maybe there's something to it. Guys, check this out. We'll be right back.
That was Gabe Witcher, fiddle player, drummer, and one of the vocalists for Punch Brothers, performing at the State Theater in Portland, Maine this Saturday. There's more about the show and the band at wordofmouthradio.org. And thanks so much for listening today. Don't forget, there are plenty of ways to enjoy the show. And if you haven't yet, you should check out the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at our website, or you can search on Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.